You're listening to Life and Letters of Paul, Lesson 12. These online lectures and study guides have been created to provide listeners all over the world the opportunity to receive theological resources online for free. Gifts received from supporters like you help us continue this exciting work. Please partner with us so that millions all over the world can continue to receive and share in the life-changing message of the gospel. Click on the Give Now button on our homepage. That's worldwide-classroom.com. Thanks for your support.
So, we are going to move exactly on time to Lecture 12 and looking at Acts 17, 22 to 31. It is an equally short as highly telling speech in the book of Acts. One of the indications that I am absolutely convinced that the speeches in the book of Acts are historical and they fit that particular context so amazingly, unless these are eyewitness reports or reports from eyewitnesses that Luke passes on to us, I don't know what. Let's go with Paul to Athens. I have already told you in the sequence of events, in the flow of thought, that in chapter 17, there's a reference to Paul going to the synagogue. Isn't it amazing? So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks. This is Athens. This is Acts 17:17. Now, which place in the United States would intimidate you most? Where would you expect to have such sharp philosophers, such educated people sitting there waxing eloquent that you just kind of want to walk out backwards as you just have entered? You name it. Harvard, Yale, pardon? Wall Street, pardon? Supreme Court, San Francisco, okay. So you fill in the blank. I say Athens, then. If you want to avoid a place where people just know a little too much for comfort, it's Athens. Not Rome. Oh, no. In Rome, they build airplanes. They have banks. They work on computers. But in Athens, they think. In Athens, they have refined their skills of rhetoric. A good speech is one that convinces. It has a well-structured flow of argument that is measured, that is weighed, that is aesthetically appealing. All kinds of aspects must come together to be convincing. It's Athens. So you don't go to Rome to be intimidated. You may be intimidated by metal there, by power, by influence, but not by philosophy, knowledge, and refinement, cultural refinement. So here Paul is. Goes to the synagogue, reasons with the Jews and the God-fearers. And then what do we read? As well as he goes to the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there. Now that you need to understand differently to a mall. A marketplace in that time is the social center where everything turns and happens. Dealing and wheeling, hiring of daily laborers, there is an intertwining of commerce and enjoyment, a little bit of Paris cafe, street side life of sitting down and having a long talk about things and just forgetting about these negligible little incidental things like work and other obligations, one cafe after the next. So you need to imagine a very lively situation, and you're just one little flea in the whole works of the marketplace. And here Paul is, and he, nearly like Socrates, seeks to engage some people. What are you doing? What are you pursuing? So he is doing a little bit of a street debate. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. Note, this is not on the Areopagus. This is not in the council of the lawyers, the attorneys. This is on the marketplace. He just meets some of these philosophers. Some of them asked, what is this babbler trying to say? Now, isn't that flattering? What is that seed picker talking about? Literally, it's a seed picker. It's somebody who's just absolutely haphazard in putting thoughts together. I mean, he has no clue of how to really engage a philosopher, according to their perspective. I think Paul could have, but he did not choose to do so. What is this seed picker all about? But somehow, he did capture some others' remark. He seems to be advocating foreign gods, plural. They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. So Paul did not beat around the bush. He did speak about the truth of Jesus, probably, though, as the speech indicates, in a very wise way. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting?" So from there he's taken to Mars Hill, most likely, which is a meeting place where about 200 to 300 people have space, against some researchers who claim the contrary. And it is basically a congress of lawyers, attorneys, that do not only debate issues of the day, but they decide legal problems of the city that lies a little bit below them and to the side, the Athens. So this is a court, but it's a kind of a mixture, a court of lawyers and thinkers. They happen to be Epicurean and Stoic in particular. Now, I have exaggerated a little bit when I said that it was Athens, the place to go to, because actually it was Athens of several hundred years before the time of Paul that would have been really the place to be at. Unfortunately, the high culture of philosophy in Athens had already deteriorated at the time of Paul to a certain point where formality was more important than content. If you could make a good speech, it didn't matter whether you were speaking for Kellogg cornflakes or something else. It sold. So that was a little bit of the degeneration that rhetoric took primacy or predominance over content and good communication of a philosophical system such as the Plato's philosophy or Aristotle's philosophy, or at least the system of questioning and inquisition that was Socrates' brand name. So a little bit of that is happening, a certain deterioration in the communication, and also an heightened curiosity of just let's hear what he says and how he says it. Not necessarily, let's seek how to explain the universe, Plato or Aristotle. Let's investigate. Should we go for the ideas and systematize the phenomena, Plato? Or should we look at the phenomena and maybe arrive at some system, Aristotle, which, by the way, is the father of the modern scientific system. It's Aristotelian evidential rather than idea-driven. That has lost its flavor a little bit, just to the curiosity. Let's just hear something. So this is a little bit of the atmosphere that Paul falls in. There is a haughtiness. There is a supremacy feeling. He obviously is not an Athenian philosopher. Who knows where this guy comes from? He does speak Greek, but that's about all. So there's this haughty, prideful attitude and a little bit of a superficiality at that point. The high culture had deteriorated a little bit to externals, to this kind of a form. Now, let's look a little bit at the two groups that are mentioned here, namely the Epicureans and the Stoics, to understand a little bit of what Paul encounters here as he preaches the gospel. What a task, isn't it, to go in the nest of a bunch of lawyers who also are Epicurean Stoic philosophers, have a good bit of rhetorical skill and finesse, and to go in there and preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. You see that here again we're coming up against the barrier of high tradition, high institution, the weight of courts, the way of privilege is just kind of breathing against you. Sometimes you get to certain institutions and you just kind of take in a deep breath. You just don't want to come with this simple little gospel of Jesus Christ of Nazareth against this huge establishment. That's how I felt in some of the German universities, where the gospel is absolutely marginalized vis-a-vis the great history of philosophical thought throughout the ages. And you kind of just feel this powerlessness. And yet, little David, i.e. Paul, takes the slingshot and aims at Goliath. This Goliath of tradition, establishment, weight, immovability, and he aims and he hits the target. That's amazing, really. It's another barrier that we may overlook as we look at racial question, ethnic questions, language question, moving geographically. This is a big one. This is a modern one. This is very much one of privilege. So who were the Stoics and Epicureans? Let's look at the Stoics a little bit. Stoics go back to Zeno, the philosopher, who instructed his followers in the following way. Now, there is, as I have said, some thought of content. So you need to kind of take my little characterizations, portraits, with a grain of salt. I'm just drawing, sketching things. I'm not refining what I'm presenting. You see here, as I present now what Stoics are after, that there is a good bit of reflection. What is the world like? The world is only material. It is a materialistic world view in which there is no outside God as creator of the space-time creation universe, outside and distinct from his creation. If you would find anything divine, like the logos intellect or the logosphere that the Stoics spoke about, it would be a force within this materialistic worldview. So it is a monistic worldview. There is not God and nature, God and Satan as an adverse power. There is one world, and it's materialistic. There's a little problem. They were not stupid, those Stoics. And what Pascal later called the misery of man, what the Bible calls sin. The Stoics identified as basic drives of man that are really destructive to happy coexistence. There are some destructive elements within this universe, which is closed, which has no God separate from its creation. There's something problem, and that is their basic drives, basic needs of man, and they seem to war against good purposes, destructive drives. The Stoics said, we've got to master those. How do we master those? There are two ways to deal with these basic drives of man. A, develop a solid apathy vis-a-vis those drives. Just reflect on the futility. Futility of sexuality, futility of power, futility of money. Think it through, for heaven's sakes, and see with an apathetic distance of a philosopher who has finally come to the heights over these low things that they're negligible. And then do one more thing. Discipline. Employ the method of apathy, employ the method of discipline, let them work together and master these horrible things that get in the way of a life, of an understanding of life that is corresponding with the good forces in nature. You want to bring yourself in accord with the good forces in nature. You want to be in harmony with nature, with the laws of nature. So you bring yourself into the system of apathy and discipline, therefore the later term of this man looked stoically at such and such, we use the adjective. Therefore the great attraction to the Roman Empire, the aristocracy in the Roman Empire of Stoic philosophy, structure, discipline, order. I think the Prussian Germans studied a lot of Stoic philosophy. I'm convinced of it. I can't prove it, but I'm sure they did. So I can really blame Zeno for the Prussian discipline. That's great, wonderful, you know, to place the blame somewhere else. So this is the way to handle it. This is the way to master it. So there's apathy and discipline. Now the Epicureans shared the materialistic worldview and shared the understanding that there's a problem. But they differed with the answer. And that's why they were a distinct group, and not, as general understanding has it, that Epicureans were those who said, just live it up. Can't help it anyway. Just let it all hang out. That's not true. The Epicureans said this: things in themselves aren't bad, but use them in moderation. It's like, don't suppress, don't have the apathy and the discipline, just kind of manage it gingerly along. Your drives, your desire for power, your materialistic greed, just kind of manage it to a harmony. Because you know what? Real happiness is not achieved by just succumbing to these drives. Ride them like horses. But it's not just go with them. It's moderation, it's balancing them nicely, playing them like an organ. So it's actually the word harmony that is the key to understanding Epicurean philosophy. But you see that there are wonderful points of contact, aren't there, between the gospel of Jesus Christ and the Stoic philosophy, the Stoic understanding. You just have to accomplish a few things first, and that's what the speech of Paul does in Athens. A few things have to be established first, especially this materialistic, immanent understanding of reality. Because if you do not know God, you're lost. You're lost in this moor of dealing with your own fallenness, trying to pull yourself out, be it with Stoic philosophy or Epicurean moderation. Unfortunately, there are some people, I know one, in the churches, and I won't name names, but his name is Hans Beyer, who falls to the Stoic way or the Epicurean way of handling the fallenness of man, rather than the gospel, which says, impossible, no way. This is idealistic philosophy. This is rubbish. When you really realize the fallenness of man, you will be brought to your knees and to call out to the Lord and say, Lord, save me or I'm lost. You see, this is all nice game. But it really doesn't cut the mustard. That's why Stoics need to hear the gospel. That's why Epicureans need to hear the gospel. And we've got a lot of Stoics and a lot of Epicureans. Those of German descent are Stoics. Those of French descent are Epicureans. And they coexist happily, but they need the gospel. Because the gospel says, you know what? This is much more serious than you thought. There's a real problem. It's not just a little problem. There's a real serious problem. And that is, this is energy gone mad. And the reason this energy has gone mad is because the initial connection to the authority of God has been broken, has run its own course, done its own thing, has become its own idol, has its own momentum, its own laws, and you will not tame it unless it is brought back under the God who is outside of this materialistic world, rather than like trying to find therein some kind of an order to make sense, either for the Stoics to conform with the laws of nature or for the Epicureans to have a certain harmony to coexist with this. So it's highly modern, obviously, nothing new under the sun. If you would go downtown to Union Station and say, are you a Stoic or are you Epicurean, they'd probably stare at you. But if you talk with them how they go about life, some person would say, you know what? I cannot commit adultery because that would ruin my law firm. Do you understand? There's a morality. There's a sense of conforming. There's a certain understanding. There's some thinking, philosophical thinking. If I do this, I'm going to be ruined. The only thing is, our society, I'm not pointing at the United States. Our society in the West particularly seems to move beyond that to say, let's scrap this. And scrap this and just let it all hang out. You know, we're all kind of in a mess and who knows what is true. That's really dangerous. A Stoic society is much better than a society that is outside of the Stoic or the Epicurean model, which simply says, sorry, that's how I am. And I'm honest about it. So we've got problems. We've got major problems because a Stoic society at least has some reflection. It's not stupid. It will not fall into every little trap simply because it feels good. It will say, wait, if I walk there, I'm going to be flat on my face. I won't do it. But it's not gospel-driven, but it's fear-driven. It's disadvantage-driven. It's I will lose out here if I do this-driven. But at least there's some brains to it. But no solution. No solution. So you must come to the gospel. How does Paul bring the gospel to these Stoics and to these Epicureans? We don't have a whole lot of time, but I will try to present to you how Paul structures his approach to the Stoic and Epicureans in Athens. Now, I would also want to say that I am not convinced that there are only Stoics and Epicureans sitting in his audience as he begins to speak. A clue to that, or a cue, is that he addresses people who believe in all kinds of gods, plural. And see, the Stoics thought it was really a good idea to believe in one logic, unifying truth within this materialistic understanding. I'm not breaking out of that suddenly, but some one unifying energy rather than all these fancy gods. I think somebody once counted all the gods and came up with 33,000 gods in Athens. I don't know, I haven't verified that number, but I think it's approximately right. So there was a third group, I believe, sitting in Paul's audience, and those were more of the popular conviction. Maybe they were lawyers, but they were not of the Stoic or Epicurean conviction. They had more of the popular pagan beliefs in many gods. And you know, there were some stones dedicated to unknown gods. There's still a debate whether there are stones dedicated to an unknown god or to unknown gods, but I'll leave that by the side. Why? 33,000 may have missed one, and he's going to be angry with you. He's going to be jealous. You did not establish a stone for him. So, just to be sure, just to be safe, let's dedicate a stone to unknown gods, so that all those whom we may have overlooked may not be jealous and feel overlooked, that we appease them. That's the whole sense of appeasing. Back from the Olympian gods to this very late stage in Greek mythology and religious feeling, there's this sense of appeasing the arbitrary, capricious sense of the gods. So, just as Paul moves in and addresses the Athenian court, I believe there are some of those. And Paul begins with a captatio benevolentiae, the address to his hearers. From the rhetoric, it is clear that you must not flatter your audience more than is right, nor less than is right. And this seems to be about right, from what we know elsewhere, that there needs to be some kind of a pleasantry presented. Paul says, I see that in all things you're very religious. Now you can take it as superstitious, or seeking after religious truths, whatever that means. Leave it vague. You take your pick. Paul probably means you're superstitious, but this is a choice word that does not offend. I've seen you have a dedication to an unknown God. Ignorance. Let me tell you about this unknown God. Obviously, that unknown God was dedicated to somebody, who knows who, and Paul is presenting the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the father of Jesus Christ. Three parts mark his address to get at the Stoic and Epicurean and perhaps the popular understanding of these Athenians. First part of the Areopag speech in verses 24 to 25 addresses the relationship of God to his world. God and the world, God and creation. The second part in verses 26 to 27 pertain to the relationship between God and man. God and man. And the third section, you see these are just two verses each, so it's a very concentrated type of a presentation. 28 to 29, verses 29, relate to the relationship between man and God. So God to creation, God and man, man to God. I can actually use arrows because there is a dynamic, there is a movement of how does God relate to his creation, how does God relate to man, how does man relate to God. You see already from the structure that there are various factors established that deal squarely with the basic flaws of Stoic philosophy. Not, you know, Paul doesn't pick a fight and says, you know, you guys with your apathy, that just won't work. At some point, that's probably going to come in. Or your discipline thing, you know, we've seen it with the Prussians, they just didn't manage it. They failed utterly, which is an anachronistic reference. So Paul establishes some basic truths, namely, there's a creator God distinct from the world. God has made man, and the only appropriate response of man is to worship God and not idols. It's a very simple summary of the argument, but you see how this is being dealt with so that then you can deal with the problem of how do we live, what do we do with our fallenness, how do we handle our lives, how do we fit in to this. But see, if you don't have this basic truth, you will get lost here. Because you will always move in your own circles and try to improve yourself. So this is fantastic how Paul establishes a basic line, and as some exegetes, some interpreters of Scripture have said, that Paul preaches to the Athenians with point of connection and point of difference at every point. So this is an amazing point of connection, appealing to some things that either the Stoics or the Epicureans or the general populace could nod and say, amen, I've always thought that. And at the same time feel the knife that says, wait a minute, no, that's too close for comfort, I can't handle that. So it's an amazing speech that does not, you know, hit you over the head, but still it challenges the Stoics and the Epicureans in a fundamental way. Namely, God has made his world. He has made his world in such a way that man can live in this world. And God relates to man. He has made one man. There's a little bit of a reference to Adam and to the origin of all mankind from one. And that was a little bit of the Stoic understanding too. They had perhaps been influenced by Old Testament thinking. There's a little allusion there. And then the big point is, since man is such an important creature, how come that you make a little something out of wood, pray to it? You hope that it will help you. You hope that it will be strong enough to lift you out of your problems. Now you see that he has something for everybody in that group. Probably this idle area, the Stoics say, amen. Gosh, these superstitious lawyers that are sitting around here. Come on. I mean, this old-fashioned religion of believing, You know, so there's some nodding and some of this, probably kind of head movement in all kinds of directions. But the final point is this. Man is created for the worship of the living God. And guess what? This God has appointed the man, Jesus, to be, oh, your judge, you lawyers. You are going to be accountable to someone. Now the great hope of the Stoics was to die and then to be freed of this physical limitation and somehow evaporate into the sphere of the ideas. So to hear of the resurrection is about as bad as anything, because it's coming back into the body and with all those problems. I mean, come on, don't preach the resurrection of the body. But that's exactly what is happening. And the only problem is, if you reject everything that Paul has said, he pronounces that every Epicurean and Stoic philosopher in that audience will have to stand trial of the one that Paul is preaching. So you have an option. You can say, well, this is a seat picker, all right. Bad, bad rhetoric, really bad content. Let's see who is next. Or you get so penetrated with understanding that really we are creatures and really the world is created by God, and maybe there is somebody that will hold me accountable, I better listen to this. This cuts to the quick. Let's forget about rhetoric. Let's forget about presentation. I need to hear. Some did. Some were affected exactly in that way. And they could hear about Christ. And then I'm sure Paul sat down and explained to them the gospel, a victory over the sin by being a bondservant of the living God and worshiping Him. The Yale and Harvard and MIT and whatever else, high tradition of the ancient world, and how Paul is able to cut to the heart of the matter of these needy Epicureans and Stoics.
Thanks for listening to this worldwide classroom lecture from Covenant Theological Seminary. Sensing a call from God to serve in ministry? Visit covenantseminary.edu. Check out our degree programs and the many other distinctives that make Covenant Seminary a place committed to equipping you for a lifetime of ministry. That's covenantseminary.edu.